Hello, everyone. My name is Hannah, and you're listening to Mystic and Murder, a paranormal, unexplained, and true crime podcast. On today's episode, we will be discussing the real story behind Annabelle. You may have already heard about the Annabelle doll due to its popularity in Hollywood. There have been three movies made about the doll: Annabelle, Annabelle Creation, and Annabelle Comes Home. While these movies are scary and fun to watch, they're all fiction-based. That's not to say that the doll didn't exist, because it did. Let's dive into the real story. It all started in Hartford, Connecticut, around 1970, when a nursing student named Donna received a birthday gift from her mom. Her mother had found an antique Raggedy Ann doll from a thrift store, and she thought that her daughter would love it. When you picture a Raggedy Ann doll, you may be thinking of today's typical stuffed dolls, somewhere around 12 to 18 inches. But this was a huge vintage version of the doll that would stand about 3 feet tall, if she could stand. Donna received the doll for Christmas, and she placed it on her bed in the apartment that she shared with her friend Angie. Just a few days after getting the doll, Donna began to notice that the doll had been moving very slightly. She would leave her room and come back to find the doll in a slightly different position than it had been before. These movements became greater, and Angie began to notice it too. They would find the doll in odd positions, like with its arms folded or its legs crossed. Sometimes they would return home to find the cloth doll standing on its feet. Once, they had found the doll sitting in a kneeling position, but no matter what they tried to do, they could not manipulate the doll to stay in a kneeling position, no matter what they tried. As time passed, things got even weirder. The doll was not only changing positions, but it would even change rooms. Donna and Angie would come home to find the doll somewhere other than they had left it. More than once, Donna placed the doll on the couch when she left for work, only to return home and find the doll on her bed, in her room, with the door shut. Both Donna and Angie were nurses who worked the same shift at the hospital, so they knew that neither one of them were moving the doll. They thought that the building super may have been playing a trick on them, coming in while they were gone and moving the doll. They decided to set up a trap one day. Before they left for work, they rigged the front door so they would know if anyone had been in their apartment. The doll was left in the bedroom. When they came home, everything was set up exactly as they had left it, and the doll was standing in the living room. Yeah, that's right. The Raggedy doll was standing on its own. One day, Donna had brought the doll out to the breakfast table and sat her in a chair. She joked that the doll was having breakfast with them. Then, they both witnessed the Raggedy Ann doll's arms begin to levitate upward and land on the table. As much as I love paranormal stories, I don't want anything to do with them personally. If I had a doll moving on its own around my house and right in front of my eyes, that thing would be gone. For some reason, though, Donna and Angie weren't fearful of the doll, but instead, they were intrigued. Lou, Angie's fiancé, told the girls that he had bad feelings about the doll and they should get rid of it, but they didn't listen. Lou even went so far as to tell them that he thought the doll was evil, but Donna had developed an attachment to it and wanted to keep it. Lou's intuition was right. About a month after bringing the doll into their home, Donna and Angie began to find little notes around the house, written on parchment paper. The messages looked like they had been written by a child, and they were harmless at first, but then they began to say things like, "Help us," or "Help Lou." The messages are creepy enough, but even weirder, Donna and Angie didn't even keep parchment paper in their apartment. So where were these notes even coming from? One night, Donna came home from work and found that the doll had moved again. It was sitting on her bed, which she came to realize was typical of the doll. This time, though, she actually had a weird feeling. She picked up the doll and saw red drops all over the back of the doll's hands and 3 drops on the doll's chest. and they looked like blood. This was enough to finally instill some fear into Donna and Angie. They decided to contact a medium for help. A seance was held, and the medium told Donna and Angie that the spirit in the doll was a little girl named Annabelle Higgins. She had lived on a property nearby, and she died at just 7 years old. Her body had been found in an empty field, which is where the apartments now stood. Annabelle relayed through the medium that she felt a sense of comfort with Donna and Angie. She wanted to stay with them and be loved by them. Donna and Angie were touched by Annabelle's story, so they gave her permission to stay in the doll and live with them. They had no idea what they had just done. Things were about to get a lot worse. Donna and Angie had welcomed the spirit of Annabelle into their home. They began to treat the doll as if it were this 7-year-old little girl, taking her places, talking to her, giving her clothes and jewelry. Lou was absolutely not a fan of this. He didn't like Annabelle, and Annabelle didn't like him. Now, there are a couple different versions of what I'm about to tell you, but the outcome is the same. One day, Lou was attacked. In one version, the story goes that Lou was sleeping in the apartment one night when he woke from having a recurring nightmare. When he woke, he felt paralyzed, like he couldn't move. He looked all around the room and everything appeared to be normal until he saw Annabelle, the doll, at his feet. She slowly moved up his leg, hovered over his chest, and then began to strangle him. Lou couldn't move and he was struggling to breathe. He blacked out. He woke up the next morning and he recalled the events of the night. He was certain that it wasn't a dream. Later that day, he and Angie were alone in the apartment looking at maps for an upcoming road trip when they heard rustling noises coming from Donna's room. Worried that someone may have broken in, Lou made his way to the room and stood outside the doorway. The noises stopped. He entered the room and he quickly turned on the light. Only Annabelle was in the room, lying on the floor as if she had been tossed in the corner. Suddenly, Lou felt like someone was behind him. He spun around, but no one was there. Then, out of nowhere, he was in immense pain. He doubled over as a burning feeling ripped through his chest. Blood began to seep through his shirt. Upon inspection, they found 7 distinct claw marks on his chest. 4 of them were horizontal, and 3 were vertical. They healed much faster than they should have, and they were fully gone within 2 days. Scary, right? In another version of the events, Lou had been taking a nap on the couch while the girls were cleaning the apartment. He woke up from the nap because he had a bad dream. Annabelle was laying at his feet on the couch, one of her usual spots. He told Angie and Donna that he had dreamt that Annabelle was strangling him, and apparently there were visible marks on his neck. He was mad and maybe a bit frightened, so he decided to taunt Annabelle. He picked up the doll and threw it across the room, saying something along the lines of, "You're just a rag doll, you couldn't hurt anyone." Immediately after, 7 slashes appeared on his body and the blood soaked through his shirt. Then, a chair flew across the room and multiple pictures fell off the wall. Loud pounding sounds surrounded them as they stood there in fear. Now, both versions of these events actually came from the same source, the same person, at different times. So, which one was accurate and which one actually happened? I guess that's up for you to decide. Either way, Donna, Angie, and Lou decided that it was time to get a priest involved. They called up the Episcopal Church and spoke with a priest named Father Hagen. Father Hagen thought that the matter was, in fact, spiritual, and that the extent of it required a higher authority in the church. He contacted Father Cook, who contacted Ed and Lorraine Warren. The Warrens are extremely well known in the paranormal community, and you're going to hear about them many times throughout the podcast. Before we get into what happened when the Warrens investigated the Annabelle case, I want to tell you more about them. We'll get into that right after this message from our sponsor. Edward Warren Miney was born on September 7, 1926. Lorraine Warren was born Lorraine Rita Moran on January 31, 1927. Ed and Lorraine met when they were just 16 years old. Ed was an usher at a movie theater that Lorraine and her mother frequently attended. When Lorraine first met Ed, the two hit it off and he ended up walking her home. That night, she wrote in her diary that she had just met the man she was going to marry. Most of their courtship happened through mail because shortly after meeting, Ed enlisted in the Navy on his 17th birthday during World War II. During one of his deployments, his ship was sunk as it collided with an oil tanker, setting it ablaze. Unfortunately, there were some casualties, but Ed survived. He was allowed a 30-day survivor leave, so he returned home. It was then that he and Lorraine decided to get married. The two were wed at 18 years old on May 22, 1945. They went on their honeymoon, and then Ed returned to war. On July 6, 1950, they had their only child, Judy, while Ed was overseas. Shortly after Judy was born, Ed concluded his service in the Navy and began pursuing one of his passions, art. He attended art school and began painting. He decided to combine his love for art with the thing that interested him most, the paranormal. As a child, Ed grew up in Bridgeport, Connecticut, in a house with strange occurrences. He lived in this house from the age of 5 to 12 years old. In his bedroom, he would see a light coming from his closet. It would form into a ball or an orb. Then he would see the face of an old lady appear from this orb. There were times when his room would be icy cold, or he would feel his bed shaking, or he could hear footsteps and breathing while no one was there. Most people, especially young children, would be extremely scared and fearful of these occurrences. But for Ed, it sparked his curiosity. He would ask his father about it. His dad was a police officer and a very practical man. Whenever Ed would ask, his dad would say, "Ed, there's a logical reason for everything in this house." Ed thought that this was funny because his dad never told him what that reason was. Ed was raised in a Roman Catholic family and he attended Catholic school. He recalled hearing the nuns talking about spirits and apparitions, and he read those words in the Bible, and he would ask the nuns and the priests about it. He began to connect what was going on in his home with the things that he was learning from school. Maybe he couldn't figure out a logical reason because there wasn't one. When Ed was 8 years old, he recalled hearing a priest speaking to his father about an exorcism that would be performed just 2 blocks away from where he lived. Ed said that even though he was a child, he understood what the priest was saying and what an exorcism meant. He believed that he was a natural-born demonologist. He already had the inner knowledge that he used in so many cases and investigations. This wasn't anything that he could learn from a book. Speaking of things that you can't learn from a book, let's talk about Lorraine. Lorraine came from a similar background as Ed. She was also raised in a Roman Catholic family, and she attended a private Catholic school. Lorraine recalled experiencing something unusual starting around the age of 9. She could see lights around people. Some people's lights had more colors, some were dimmer, and some were brighter than others. She thought that it was completely normal and that everyone could see the lights. In reality, her clairvoyance was beginning to develop and she could now see people's auras. Lorraine describes a person's aura as a supernatural glow that emanates from a person's physical body. It depicts our personality, our health, and our spiritual well-being. She soon learned that she couldn't speak about her abilities at school because it was very frowned upon. Once, she got in trouble because she had mentioned to a friend that one sister's lights were brighter than another's. One of the sisters overheard this, and she was punished and told not to speak of those things. This is when she learned that she was different. If she spoke about the lights at home, it was only okay if it was talked about in a lighthearted, joking manner, but it wasn't something that she could seriously discuss. She knew that she was different, and she knew that she didn't want to be. When it came to believing in ghosts and the supernatural realm, Lorraine was skeptical at first. She was very firm in her belief of a heaven, a hell, and a purgatory. She was unsure about ghosts and spirits being able to reside and haunt things in our world. Ed, on the other hand, had experienced these things firsthand in his childhood home. He wanted to know if there were other people out there who experienced the same things he did. Ed would read and learn all about the haunted places in the New England region, and then he would paint them. He and Lorraine would set up pop-up stands throughout the tourist areas of Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Vermont. His paintings would sell anywhere from $3 to $5 a piece, and that was great money for the time. Once, when traveling through New Hampshire, they passed a town called Henniker. Ed had recently read about a haunted house in a town called Henniker, the Oceanborn Mary House. Just as he was wondering if this could be the same town that he had read about, he passed a sign that read, "The only Henniker on Earth." They found the house and they were able to speak with the homeowner, Lewis Roy. While inside, Ed and Lewis were talking right along when Ed asked Lorraine a question. He then noticed that Lorraine appeared to be in a trance-like state, and she was just gazing off. Ed asked what was going on, and Lewis said, "Oh, that happens with a lot of clairvoyance in this house." This was Lorraine's first real experience with her sixth sense beyond seeing auras. She was having an out-of-body experience. She later explained it as a loud ringing in her ears, and then a sudden jolt in her body. The next thing she knew, she was looking down on Ed, Lewis, and herself. Lorraine said that this was the first time she knew not to fear death. Lorraine's clairvoyance had reached a new level. This intrigued her, and she now had a better understanding of the supernatural realm. In an interview on their show, Seekers of the Supernatural, she stated that she never tried to develop her abilities, but they developed on their own from the situations that she had exposed herself to. After this experience at the Oceanborn Mary House, Ed and Lorraine continued to seek out the supernatural. Ed would learn of a new haunted house, and he and Lorraine would go seek it out. Ed used his artistic talents as a way to learn more about the place. When they found it, he would stand outside and make a sketch or a painting of the house, ghosts included. Then, Lorraine would take the sketch, knock on the door, and use her charming Irish personality to befriend the owner of the house. She would show them the painting and say, "My husband made this for you." And their plan actually worked. The owner would then allow them into the house, and they would get to learn more about their firsthand experiences. After a while, it naturally progressed from them just talking about ghosts with the homeowners to people actually calling them in on cases. In 1952, the Warrens founded the New England Society of Psychic Research. They devoted their lives to helping others afflicted by the supernatural. They worked with people of all faiths, and they never asked for payment for their services. Ed would go into an investigation with a practical approach, trying to find a logical explanation first. He wanted to figure out what was going on and rectify it. He used his knowledge of demonology, and Lorraine would use her clairvoyance to determine what was in the house. By the time they were called in to help with the Annabelle case, they had already been investigating cases for about 20 years. After receiving the call from Father Cook, the Warrens made the hour drive from their home in Monroe, Connecticut, to Hartford, Connecticut. When they arrived, Ed began to question Donna, Angie, and Lou. The Warrens asked them if they had ever seen the spirit of Annabelle, which they had not. When learning the details of the haunting, the Warrens came to an immediate conclusion that the doll was not actually inhabited by the spirit of a girl named Annabelle. Instead, it was being manipulated by a demonic entity. This spirit was showing intent, or intelligence. It was also bringing on phenomena of a certain nature and intensity that human spirits cannot do. The Warrens explained that spirits do not and cannot possess inanimate objects. The doll was being manipulated by an inhuman spirit. The entity created an illusion, making it seem as if the doll was alive in order to gain recognition. Its ultimate goal would be human possession. The doll moving on its own and teleporting were a part of what Ed and Lorraine called the infestation stage. Once the spirit had the girls' attention, their curiosity was piqued and they made the predictable mistake of contacting a medium in an attempt to communicate with the doll. Now, the entity had the ability to communicate with the girls through the medium, and it preyed on the girls' emotional vulnerabilities by feeding them lies and pretending to be the spirit of a young girl who just wanted love and attention. When the girls then allowed the spirit of Annabelle to remain in the doll and stay in the apartment, it gave the entity permission to haunt the apartment. It then began to instill fear in them by materializing notes with cryptic and eerie messages on them, materializing the symbolic drops of blood on the doll, and finally by attacking Lou and leaving three claw marks, the symbolic mark of the beast. The Warrens believed that the entity was close to fulfilling the next stage of infestation, which would have been complete human possession. They also believed that if Donna and Angie had allowed this to continue for another 2 to 3 weeks, the spirit would have possessed, harmed, or even killed one or all of them. After determining what the spirit was, they immediately called Father Cook to perform an exorcism over Donna, Angie, Lou, and the whole apartment. Father Cook agreed to cleanse the apartment and perform the exorcism. Ed Warren said, quote, "The Episcopal blessing of the home is a wordy 7-page document that is distinctly positive in nature. Rather than specifically expelling evil entities from the dwelling, the emphasis is instead directed towards filling the home with the power of the positive and of God." End quote. After the cleansing and blessing of the apartment, Donna requested that the Warrens remove the doll from her home. The Warrens obliged and took the Raggedy Ann doll with them when they left. This was not the first time that the Warrens had taken a haunted object, and it wouldn't be their last. In their home in Monroe, Connecticut, they had an occult museum in their basement. It was filled with objects that were haunted, cursed, used for ritualistic practices, and more. Annabelle would be just another addition. On the car ride home, they decided to take the back roads and avoid the interstate just in case the entity was still within the doll. Their decision to be cautious was a good one because their car kept stalling, their brakes failed multiple times, and their power steering went out. After the car stalled for the third time, Ed grabbed a vial of holy water that he had with him and doused the doll, making the sign of a cross over it. From that point on, there were no issues and the Warrens were able to make it home safely. At home, Ed placed the doll in his office in a chair by his desk. In the next few weeks, the doll levitated many times, but after a while, that stopped. It would also teleport itself into another room, like it did at Donna and Angie's apartment. The Warrens also claimed to see a black cat occasionally materialize next to the doll's side, and later dematerialize from the head down. Weird. Because of their job, the Warrens were often in contact with different clergymen who the doll showed great disdain towards. Once, Lorraine said that a clergyman had called and left a voicemail on their home phone. Lorraine was home at the time, but she didn't have a chance to pick it up. She said when the phone began ringing, she heard a loud, rolling growl throughout the house. Then, when she listened to that voicemail, she could hear the same growl on the recorded message as well. In another instance, a Catholic exorcist named Father Bradford came to the house. He and Ed were talking about the doll after Father Bradford had noticed it sitting in the chair. Father Bradford picked up the doll and taunted it, saying to the doll, "You're just a rag doll, you can't hurt anyone." And he tossed the doll back into the chair. Ed warned him that he shouldn't have said that. When he left the house, Lorraine had an eerie feeling and told Father Bradford to drive safe and please call when he got back to the rectory. He said he would. A few hours later, the Warrens received a call. It was Father Bradford, and he asked Lorraine why she had told him to drive safe. She told him that she just had a bad feeling that something was going to happen to him. He confirmed this by telling her that he was just in a near-fatal accident. His brakes had failed, and his new car was struck in the middle of an intersection. The doll wasn't only after clergymen, though. It was dangerous to anyone who touched it or taunted it. Once, a detective was at Ed and Lorraine's house because Lorraine often used her clairvoyance to help in missing person cases. While the detective was there, he asked Ed if he could see the museum. Ed agreed, and they went down to the basement. While they were in Ed's office, the detective spotted Annabelle. He told Ed that he just couldn't take his eyes off the doll. Ed had to step out for a minute to take a personal phone call, so he warned the officer not to touch anything because everything in that room was unholy and unsafe. A few minutes later, the detective came running up the stairs and he was shaking and he couldn't talk. At first, Ed thought that he was having a heart attack. He was about to call an ambulance because there was no 911 at the time, but finally the detective could speak and he said that he would talk to Lorraine about what happened. He did, and while we don't know everything that happened in the basement, we do know that he had touched Annabelle. After these instances, the Warrens had a special case built to contain Annabelle. Over the years, two special cases have been made for the doll. The one that it currently sits in is a portable case made of wood and glass. There are placards of the Archangel, Saint Michael, on both sides of the case, and there are three crosses, two on the sides of the case and one on the top of the case that represent the Holy Trinity. The stain used to color the wood is infused with holy oil and holy water. There is also a tarot card of the devil stuck to the front of the case, and a sign that says, "Warning, positively do not open." According to the Warrens, if someone were to touch the doll, the spirit's aura would intermingle with the person's aura, causing a bad reaction. Since placing the doll in the case, it no longer appeared to move, but that doesn't mean that it's not still dangerous. Once, a young man and his girlfriend were visiting the Warrens' occult museum. They were looking at Annabelle when Ed overheard him taunting the doll, banging on the case, and saying, "If you're real, put scratches on me." Ed immediately kicked him out of the museum. On their way home, the young man lost control of his motorcycle, and he and his girlfriend crashed head-on into a tree. He died instantly, and his girlfriend was hospitalized and in a coma for over a year. When she woke up, she was asked if she remembered what happened when they crashed, and she did. She said that she and her boyfriend had been laughing about the doll when they lost control. Today, Annabelle still resides in the Warrens' Occult Museum, even though they have passed on. Ed passed away at his home on August 23, 2006, at the age of 79. Lorraine passed away on April 19, 2019, at the age of 92. They left the New England Society of Psychic Research and the Occult Museum in the hands of their daughter Judy and their son-in-law Tony Spera. Judy also possesses some psychic abilities just like her mother, but she has not attempted to develop it. She actually doesn't want much to do with anything involving the supernatural realm. The stories relayed to her by her father scared her enough to not want to investigate in the more serious cases. While she's still involved in the New England Society of Psychic Research, she more so serves as a voice of reason. Her husband, Tony, on the other hand, is all in. He had been working with the Warrens since the 1980s and is considered an expert in paranormal research. He and his team continue the Warrens' legacy and continue to help families afflicted by the paranormal. Tony also serves as the curator of the Warrens' Occult Museum. It's been closed off to the public since 2019 due to zoning issues, but Annabelle, along with many other haunted items, are still locked away and safeguarded. In 2020, there was a rumor that Annabelle had escaped from the museum, but it was just that. Tony Spera made a public video announcing that Annabelle was still at the museum, which has very good security, and he had just moved the doll to a safer location due to people lurking around the house. He left off with an eerie warning, saying that he appreciates the concern, and he would also be concerned if Annabelle really did leave, because she is nothing to play with. That's all for today's episode. New episodes of Mystic and Murder will be posted every other Sunday. Tune in, follow, and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and more. You can find the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at Mystic and Murder. You can send in an email to mysticandmurder@gmail.com with suggestions, requests, and even personal spooky stories. If you like what you hear and you want to support the podcast, you can go to www.patreon.com/mysticandmurder. You can click support at anchor.fm/mysticandmurder. You can make a donation at paypal.me/mysticandmurder, or you can buy Mystic and Murder merchandise. Head to mysticandmurder.com/shop to learn more. Thank you all so much for listening, and I hope you sleep tight. Remember, all things weird lurk at night.